knew, there would be no more communications with Baikonur. Something exploded. For a flash of an instant, Williamson was certain that the rocket had blown up and they were about to be killed. Then an enormous, invisible hand squeezed down on his chest so hard he could barely breathe. His arms were too heavy to lift off the seat rests. Pain and terror flaring through him, he managed to turn his head toward Nikolaev. The Russian's face looked as if someone were flattening it out with an invisible pressing iron. The noise and vibration were terrifying. Williamson couldn't see Buchachi on the other side of the Russian. The pressure got worse, and all of a sudden Williamson's bladder let go. He heard a moan and wondered if it was his own tortured voice or Buchachi's. And then it stopped. It all just suddenly stopped. No noise, no vibration, no pressure. Williamson saw his arms floating up off the seat rests as if they had a will of their own. He turned his head to look at Nikolaev, and a surge of dizziness made his eyes water. He felt as if he were going to upchuck.
"Zero gravity," said Nikolaev happily. "In 45 minutes, we make rendezvous with transfer rocket."
Williamson wondered if he could survive 45 minutes without heaving up his guts into the fishbowl helmet. Matagorda Island, Texas.
"Now remember," Dan shouted, standing in the middle of the hangar floor, "this was just a rehearsal. Tomorrow's the real thing."
Hardly anyone paid any attention to him. They were all swilling champagne, laughing, pounding each other on the back. Even Niles Mohammed, normally as grim as the angel of death, was shaking up bottles of champagne and spraying them on whoever happened to be in range of the cold white geyser.
"Give it up, Chief," said Lynn Van Buren, her inevitable dark pantsuit stained with Mohammed's champagne spray. "They've earned an afternoon of fun."
Frowning with helplessness, Dan said, "I don't want them hung over tomorrow."
"They'll be okay. Let them let off steam. They'll get a good night's sleep."
Van Buren drifted off into the crowd, and Dan slowly realized that he was alone. Joe Tenney wasn't there to share this moment with him. Claude Passot had gone back to New Orleans. Even April was nowhere in sight. "I wish Jane could have been here," he said to himself. "She'll come down tomorrow, but Scanwell will be with her. And 600 other VIPs and newspeople. Vicky Lee, most probably. Wonder if she'll stay the night." Feeling suddenly unbearably sad, drained, disappointed, like a man who had spent his last ounce of energy to reach a mountain peak, only to find that it wasn't worth the struggle. Dan walked slowly toward the stairs leading up to his office and his apartment. Then he stopped. No sense going up there with all this noise going on down here. "There's no place for me to go," he realized. "No place at all." He began to drift through the crowd looking for April. She's going to have a lot to do tomorrow with all the news media coming in. Better make sure she doesn't get too much champagne into her. Off in the farthermost corner of the hangar, away from the whooping, sloshing crowd, Al-Bashir was speaking quietly, intently, to April. One hand holding a plastic cup of California champagne, he leaned against the metal wall of the hangar with his other hand, neatly pinning April against the wall.
"France?" April asked. "You mean Paris?"
"Marseille, actually," he said smoothly. "On the Mediterranean. We can go to Paris afterward, if you like." April looked surprised, almost alarmed. But she murmured,
"I've never been to France."
"Marseille is not far from the Riviera," Al-Bashir said. "They make the world's best bouillabaisse there."
"I've heard of that. It's like a sort of fish stew, isn't it?"
"With certain exotic ingredients added."
"Like saffron?"
Al-Bashir smiled. "You'll love it."
"But there's so much to do here,"
April said, her eyes evading his. "We can leave tomorrow afternoon, after the turn-on ceremony. Surely Dan owes you a few days' vacation."
"I really don't think I could..."
Her voice faded away. Al-Bashir put his arm down and stood up straight, almost at attention. "You will have your own hotel suite, I promise you. You'll be perfectly safe." A slight smile touched her lips.
"Can I trust you?"
"Of course," he lied. As soon as she got to her apartment that evening, her head buzzing from the champagne, April phoned Kelly Emmons in Houston. No answer. She left messages on both Kelly's office line and her cell phone. Saturday evening, April thought. She's probably out on a date. April fell asleep as she sat in her living room recliner watching a detective show on television. It always worked out so neatly on TV. They caught the murderer in 1 hour flat, even taking timeouts for commercials. The phone rang and she instantly snapped awake. Hi, April. It's me, Kelly. Holding the cordless phone as she got up from the recliner, April said, Let me put you on the computer, okay?
Sure.
It took a few moments for April to boot up her desktop machine and get Kelly's freckle-faced image on her screen. Once she did, she told the FBI agent about al-Bashir's invitation.
To Marseille, Emmons echoed.
That's a major narcotics port.
Narcotics? Do you think?
Emmons's brows knit.
There's nothing linking him to drugs.
Nothing linking him to much of anything outside of his connections with that bozo Roberto.
He seems nice enough,
April said half-heartedly.
I don't like the idea of you being alone with him, in France yet.
April tried to make light of it.
What's he going to do? Kidnap me and carry me off to his harem?
He has a harem, you know, in the city of Tunis.
Really?
Frowning, Emmons said,
We've checked with the CIA about him.
He seems to be nothing more than a big-time international businessman.
A billionaire. But you think he might be linked to the murders here at Astro?
It's only a straw, Emmons admitted. But it's the only straw we've got.
Maybe if I go with him we can learn more, April suggested.
Maybe if you go with him you could get hurt. Badly. April replied,
He doesn't want to hurt me. He just wants to go to bed with me.
And what do you want? Without an eye blink's hesitation, April said,
I want to find out who killed Joe Tenney. And Pete Larson.
And that test pilot. Nodding, April said,
And what they're planning next.
That's damned dangerous, April.
But he doesn't know I'm working with you. He just thinks I'm an available woman.
Emmons' scowl deepened.
He wants to fly off to Marseille tomorrow afternoon? After we turn on the power set, yes.
We'll have to act fast, then.
And do what?
I've got to round up a medical team and get them down there tonight, said Emmons.
A medical team?
You're going to get an implant.
I'm on the pill, April blurted.
Emmons shook her head.
Not for contraception, silly. This implant is a micro-tracker. We've got to know exactly where you are every second you're with him.
Gathering forces. Sunday dawned cloudy and gray. Not a good omen, Dan thought, looking out his window as he got dressed. Shirt and tie this morning, he told himself. You've got to look like the successful, prosperous captain of industry. April was at her desk, on the phone, when he entered his office. But she looked drawn, tired, as if she hadn't slept all night. Nervous? Dan wondered. Well, she's had an awful lot to do these past couple of weeks, and today's going to be the busiest day of her life. Once he had booted up his computer, he saw that Mitch O'Connell's name was at the top of his to-call list. Dan clicked on the name and the phone made the connection.
There's about 150 of them picketing out by the main gate, the security chief said, his heavy-jawed face grim.
Are they making any trouble? Dan asked.
Not yet, but wait till the VIPs start showing up.
Dan thought swiftly. Jane and Scanwell were flying in, as were many of the other invited guests. They'd come right into the airstrip, bypassing the perimeter gate. But the news people would be coming in their vans, and they're the ones the pickets want to impress. Soon as they see the TV vans, they'll start harassing the limos trying to get through the main gate. Send a set of cars to the ferry dock, he said to O'Connell, and have the drivers guide the arriving guests down to the secondary road. Let them in through the back gate. O'Connell said worriedly,
That way they'll be driving right past the launch pad.
That's okay. Fine, in fact. Give them something to gawk at before they park at the control center. The TV crews will love it.
I don't know if I have enough people to do it.
Dan sighed. The ultimate bureaucratic ploy. I need more people. Call in as many people as you need. Holiday pay scale. Call in the state police for double damn sake. Okay, boss,